This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll bring in reporters from media across Northwest Indiana and the state to talk about the big stories here in the region as well as the Hoosier State. We'll hear from reporters like Greg Tejeda with the Northwest Indiana Post-Tribune, Eric Weddle, who's public radio education reporter, Andy Ober with Inside Indiana Business has some interesting stories, including one that has an impact on Northwest Indiana, and we'll have Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio with us to talk about stories that he's covered, including yesterday's appearance before a special Chamber of Commerce meeting. We begin this Reporter Roundtable Thursday today with a look at educational stories from not only Northwest Indiana impact, but also across the Hoosier State. Eric Weddle is an education reporter and covers other topics for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He's based out of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis. Eric, thanks once again for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
No problem. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start out here with a story that I know that your colleague Claire McInerney had covered in more detail here about the addition of some members to the State Board of Education. Actually, one previous member who was from Northwest Indiana. Tell us about what Governor Holcomb did.
Yeah, well, so there were currently two positions that were unfilled on the board because two members had resigned earlier this year. So he waited 6 months almost to fill them, and he chose Kathleen Moat, who is currently a chancellor at Ivy Tech College in the southeast region, to be a member. She's a Republican. She's a Republican. And then he chose. Tony Walker, a lawyer from Gary, a Democrat, to also be on the board. And Tony Walker was previously a board member, and some people may remember back when Governor Mike Pence was in office, along with Glenda Ritz. There was a lot of fighting on the board, and there was kind of a reshuffle in mid-2015 of the board members, and Mr. Walker is one of the members who left the board at that time. So it's interesting to see that the governor has chosen to pick him to come back once again.
Was there any statement that the governor made when he made the appointments, and in particular with getting Mr. Walker back on the board?
Not really. He didn't actually even refer to that, just that he thought that he would be a good member for that region. He's a strong supporter of school choice, which is something that the governor is also. And, you know, what is also interesting is that he right now is part of a bid to be part of a group of people who wants to take over the Gary school system,
elementary schools. That's right. Yeah, Mr. Walker is involved with organizations that would like to be the group that the distressed unit appeals board will select as the financial mm-hmm. manager for the Gary Community Schools. Huh? One of the other topics that came up this week in education that you've covered talks about some low-performing private schools, but some schools, I guess, apparently that have gotten some special approval to take on some new vouchers, and maybe something that they probably should focus more on in making the schools better as opposed to looking for more students.
Right. So there was a law that was signed, you know, a few months ago from this recent session that allows failing voucher schools to request a waiver to once again be able to accept new students. The current law says if you're a voucher private school who takes vouchers, if you're rated a D or an F for two consecutive years on the state accountability scale, you lose the ability to accept new students. You can keep your current ones, but you can't take any new students in. And some schools were to lawmakers to have this new law passed that would allow the State Board of Education to basically grant them a waiver and let them once again take in new voucher students after only 1 year instead of two or more years of better academic performance. Mm-hmm. And so the State Board voted 6-2 to approve these four schools, three in Indianapolis and one in Fort Wayne, to have these waivers. And the schools, three of the schools previously had consecutive Ds, and one of them had consecutive F scores.
I know that one of the board members not pleased with the decision to try to get those vouchers to continue, and you wrote into your story that has been online as well as on the air about what Gordon Hendry had to say about that.
Right. So Gordon Hendry, just to also make a note, he was reappointed as well last week onto the State Board of Education by Governor Holcomb. But yeah, Mr. Henry basically is concerned just about the accountability. There have been changes in how A to F grades are calculated. So in last year, the state saw many fewer schools rated D or F. So it's very hard to compare the current grades now to the grades schools previously got. So Mr. Henry's concern was, even if these schools have shown 1 year of academic improvements, are they really improvements that we can count on to ensure students are getting a good education, because we can't compare this grade to the last grade? And while he's not against the waiver, he kind of wants there to be more time passed before these schools come before the board.
And I know
of course, the board did not agree.
I know that one of the things that you noted in your story was a concern that the State Board of Education has about the entire Choice Scholarship Program. Tell us what this program is all about and why the State Board of Education is not real pleased with it.
The Choice Scholarship Program?
Yes.
Well, I think I wouldn't say that they're not pleased with it. I would say Superintendent Jennifer McCormick has raised some concerns, and the Choice Scholarship Program is the law that allows private schools to accept public dollars through vouchers for low-income and middle-class families can apply for this, and then they can use these vouchers to pay for the tuition at a private school. The program has gone on now since 2011. It costs around the upwards of $145 million a year, but there has been no studies done in terms of the academic studies or the financial studies of how the money is used, or if the students using these vouchers are getting a better education mm-hmm. than if they were in a private school. Researchers at Notre Dame are currently working on the first ever academic study about this program, and hopefully we'll be able to report soon on what those results have.
So I suppose they're really, the board's more concerned about accountability, especially when you've got so much money that's at stake here.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, right now there's no laws that these schools have to be audited. So the private schools who get these dollars, they don't have to go through any auditing process or kind of explain how the money is used, unlike a public charter school or unlike a traditional public school. Yeah, so some board members did raise the concern that the accountability for them is much less than a traditional public school.
Now, you've had a lot of very serious news come up on the education scene this week, but you had a chance, I know, to do a very good story that's online as well, too, about the Indianapolis Public Schools Teacher of the Year.
Sure.
Who has some very good comments to make here that certainly any educator anywhere in the state, including here in the region, could take note of, and in particular in communities like Northwest Indiana, where you have such a multicultural literacy issue. Tell us what Kathleen Routh had to say.
Right. So she's been an educator for 30 years. She's only been with IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools, for 3 years, but she was nominated and won the Teacher of the Year. And she is a media specialist. She works in the library at two magnet schools in the city. And she really wants to focus on finding books that students at the school can relate to. And, you know, like the Gary school system, IPS is a very high minority enrollment. But unlike Gary, most of the teachers in Indianapolis are white teachers. So she has really worked hard to find books that relate to African-American students, Hispanic students, and kind of give them a different look at how they see themselves, maybe that they won't see themselves in the mainstream media or in the news. And she said she spends 2 to 3 hours a day searching out small press and different types of books that really will let students relate to and find interesting stories about families and about dreams and about just the different types of rich literature that these students can relate to. And it was really inspiring just to hear how dedicated she is and how much the students at her school really enjoy working with her and getting these books.
Now, I understand that she is, before she took her education career to Indianapolis and to schools in the IPS, she had worked in the Evanston-Skokie School District,
right,
number 65, up on the north side of Chicago and north suburbs. So she obviously has had some instances where she's had a chance to learn certainly more about multicultural literacy, and she's been able to put that experience in good use here in Indianapolis, looks like.
Right. Well, I mean, she refers to herself as a upper middle class white suburban Ohio woman, mm-hmm. where she comes from. So she said, you know, she's really had to kind of see who she is, where she comes from, and realize she has to relate to these students in a totally different way, so she can reach them and provide them with, you know, the education and resources that they can relate to and benefit from.
Now, does being the Indianapolis Public Schools Teacher of the Year bring any special benefits, or do you have to work harder to look for that higher, aspire to that higher honor, which is Indiana Teacher of the Year?
Well, I think that is the one benefit it comes with is now she is in a running to become the State Teacher of the Year. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, she is hopeful, you know, in this position that she can kind of go around maybe, you know, not only the district, but with the city possibly to talk more about what she is doing. She says she does get a lot of calls from other librarians and media specialists about how to find these kind of books that she is finding. You know, one thing that we wrote about in the story was she talked about how she, you know, found some books about young children who have a same-sex mother or father, and that there was a student in the school who found one of these books who has a same-sex parent and was very excited to finally read a book that they could relate to. So she's really hoping to explain to other schools how they can find these books and build these libraries for students.
That's great. Recently, you had a chance to catch up with U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos when she made an appearance at a school on the near west side of Indianapolis when she was in the Hoosier State. And I know that one of the other stories come up here that she's had a chance to talk with an entire organization of charter schools advocates recently. And it was one of the stories that you mentioned that we ought to probably bring up during the program today. Tell us about that.
Sure. So she spoke at this national conference of charter school associations, and it was an interesting talk. I mean, I think people are very interested to see what her views are in terms of the policy that she's now in control of at the national level. But she kind of gave them, I would say, a little bit of tough love, kind of reminding them that charter schools are not the only choice option in the country right now. And she is a major advocate of the school vouchers, which we discussed just a few minutes ago, and she actually is one of the main reasons it exists in Ohio by funding much of the lobbying here. So when she spoke to them, I think she was kind of letting them know that her administration, the Trump administration, is also going to be favoring these other forms of choice, that charter schools won't be the only game in town. She really didn't discuss a lot, you know, of what we can expect out of the administration, but we do know it is going to be some type of deregulation that she talked about. She wants to make it easier for all types of schools, including charter schools and voucher schools, to apply for funding and apply for grants from the federal government.
I know that's certainly here in Northwest Indiana and the Gary area in particular, watching very closely because there's such a plethora of charter schools in just the Gary Community School District alone, and around here as well too. There will be watching to find out what kind of indication we might get from Washington and even the White House about this as well too. We'll find out what happens. We've been talking with Eric Weddle, who is education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He's based out of WFYI, Public Radio in Indianapolis. Eric, thank you very much for taking time with us here on the program to talk about these stories and some other interesting topics as well, and hope to be back with you soon.
Great. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. On Reporter Roundtable Thursday, it's time to take a look at what's been happening lately in the city of Gary, and for that, we're turning to Greg Tejeda, who's a Gary city reporter for the Post-Tribune. Thank you very much for once again being with us today, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start out here talking about some business news. You had a story recently in the Post-Tribune about HMD Trucking. If that company name doesn't mean anything, it means that it's a company that has picked up a lot of notoriety in the city of Gary in the hopes that the city officials are hoping will bring a lot of new jobs into the community. But they're kind of on the line on some things here. And I know the city's council has said that we want you to do a bit more than just bring a business front to here. You want to, especially jobs and I guess a reason for people to actually come to work in Gary.
Right, and the city officials in negotiating the deal to help HMD come to Gary had actually gone out of the way to throw in some clauses that would actually penalize HMD if later on it would turn out they don't hire a lot of Gary residents and Gary businesses for their local contracts. In some cases, the HMD could wind up facing fines if they don't hit a certain percentage. They've actually worked out one position where Gary residents' criminal record as an issue not to consider hiring them. You know, they've worked out these clauses, and so far when I talk to HMD, they indicate they have no problem. They think they're actually better off if they have a large pool of local workers nearby. They don't have to make a decision. So they claim they'll have no problem complying.
Mm-hmm. Where is this company planning to relocate their trucking terminal and offices?
The actual address is 1350 Texas Street. And part of the deal, the city is going to have to repave part of 15th Avenue, so that there will be direct access from I-65 to the Texas Street Express. So they're out there, out in the northeast corner of town.
Mm-hmm. Is it a particular project that the city is interested in, no doubt, because of not only the business proper that they can bring in, but also the fact that they can help get jobs and train people for jobs that that might develop into some other businesses there in Gary?
That would always be their hope. I mean, they've actually managed to work out deals between HMD and the Ivy Tech, which has their own programs for training people for a commercial driver's license, so that Ivy Tech drivers will even get priority in terms of truck driver jobs mm-hmm. that will be created at the new place.
Now, where do we stand right now with the Common Council as well as with HMD Trucking and getting this project moving and actually getting to see something go up out there in that neighborhood?
The council actually took their final vote last week. However, there's actually another measure that the Gary Redevelopment Commission still has to approve, and that's actually going to come up when they meet again next week, Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So this still has a few procedural steps to go, but I've got officials telling me that probably by the summer we're going to start seeing actual work taking place,
mm-hmm.
being built, so that this can open up next year, early next year.
So this is certainly far from happening. At least it's moving ahead. So that I guess if the Redevelopment Commission goes along with everything that's being talked about, that at least it'll get one step closer to being a reality then.
Definitely.
One of the other
Go ahead.
I was going to ask you. Go ahead.
It should also be pointed out that even the city officials are admitting that these talk of creating 500 new jobs, it's probably spread out over a five-year period. So it's not like it's going to be immediately 500 new jobs come next spring.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a little time to get there.
Well, we'll see what happens. If they said they have to get the approval to get initially set up in Gary anyway, we'll find out in that respect what happens there too. One of the other things I know that the Gary Common Council brought up was talking about something has turned out to be very popular. There's some preservation tours that are being offered in the city of Gary. Tell us what the council's done and how that's going to benefit people that would like to check out some of Gary's history by just walking or driving around.
Well, what wound up happening, these are being funded part through a state grant and part through private donations, and it turns out the private donations came in a little higher. They got like an extra $1,000 to play with in terms of money to make sure they can prep all these sites so that people can wander around without injury. Some of these buildings are, I don't want to say totally decrepit, but you know there are some potential safety issues if you're not careful.
Mm-hmm. I don't
anyway, they've already done one round of tours last month that were actually guided tours, you know, invitation only. You had to have a ticket in advance. This Saturday, they're actually having their open event where people can just come. You can check out the site as you wish, take your own time going about. If you want to spend an entire afternoon working your way up and down Broadway, checking out the sites, that's your choice.
Now, that's one thing we think we probably should note here, that the tours basically focus on some architectural interesting items that happen to be along Broadway. Are there any others that are maybe in the neighborhood on either side of Broadway, on side streets, that are part of this tour?
It depends how you'd want to consider side streets. I mean, technically, I suppose you could say the City Methodist Church being over on Washington and the old post office being on Massachusetts. But those are still within a block of Broadway.
So they're part of the tour because they are part of the tour. They're part of the history of Gary, and they aren't that far. So if you wanted to stay pretty close to Broadway, you didn't have to wander very far to look at something interesting and then come back and continue on the tour, then it looks like. That's interesting.
It would be like about a six-block strip of Broadway up and down, you know, if you want to do the whole thing and hit everything.
From what you've learned in talking with people, not only at City Hall but elsewhere, people have been involved in some of these other tours. They seem to be pleased with what the city set up for this redevelopment tour.
I haven't heard anyone complain. Actually, I've heard one person complain.
Oh, really?
Someone who tends to complain about everything.
Oh, okay. Well, we can take that, I guess, into account too. One of the other stories, in fact, it's in the Post Tribune here as of today, is talking about trying to get artists interested to offer some ideas for making downtown Gary a very artsy, beautiful place. Tell us about the project that the Redevelopment Commission has in mind and how they want to get artists in the community involved.
The Legacy Foundation is going to work with the Gary Redevelopment Commission. They're providing some money. They want to hire 8 local artists. By local, either somebody who lives or works in Gary or has family who lives and works in Gary, who will create works of art that can be set up in public spots around downtown. Some of these are spots where you could erect a statue. Some of these are open walls in the sides of buildings where you could do a mural. And right now, the Legacy Foundation is in the process of seeking the local artists. You know, you contact the Legacy Foundation, let them know your credentials. You have until the June 30th. And then if they're interested, they think you're serious enough, back next month. Mm-hmm. And by August, they're going to pick the exit artists they're going to work with. And they will be providing money, amounts of between $3,000 to $25,000, depending on the project, depending on how much it costs. You know, they're trying to encourage the idea of, you know, beautifying the downtown area. This is an extension of the effort that already put that mural near Fifth Avenue on Broadway of the Jackson 5. And then also later this summer is going to be setting up works of art around the bus stops along Broadway between Fourth Avenue all the way down to Crown Point.
I understand that they're going to take advantage of some open spaces, some because of facilities that have been, I guess, abandoned or certainly expanded upon, then use those spaces to display some of this artwork, I guess. Gateway Park, I understand, is one of them. You're talking about more things happening along Broadway. That's one spot that they'd like to put up some of this art, I understand.
Yes, although I've also been told, the Legacy Foundation has told me, ultimately the artists will get to pick which site they want to build at, which one they think they can best do something with. So in the end, the actual sites will be determined later this year working with the artists.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably fair for them to do, because they're the ones that can have some great ideas, so they can come by, take a look at that spot that they maybe think they can do something best with and create something that's going to fit right in and benefit the city as well as their own artistic viewpoint too.
Most definitely. You know, you would think the artists would have some sense, particularly if they actually do wind up knowing the area, that a tie to the community.
Now, we know this, that's not related, but there is something, of course, of interest that's already been established that is involving art in Gary, and that's, of course, the atmosphere that is around the Art House, which is Art House. I should say the official title is Art House, a Social Kitchen, and that's one of the projects first established as part of the Knight Foundation's City's Challenge in Gary, and I'm sure that that'll probably get some benefit from all this other artwork that's going to go up in the city.
Definitely. Although there are also city officials, when they view Art House, often view it as more a chance to give people, because it's a potential art gallery, but it also has the extensive kitchen facilities for the fact that it used to be a barbecue restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And they view it as a place to train potential future chefs, people who have an interest in getting into the restaurant business, let them gain a little experience. And in fact, later today, there's going to be an event at the Art House where they're going to be honoring some of the people program and become a part of the Gary business community in future years.
Well, that's great. That's great. And yeah, we should note that has been really all the intent ever since the project started, that it's supposed to be a culinary incubator, and the art is probably not necessarily incidental, but it's very much part of the entire project, but it's not the total part of the project. The total part of the project is to help create jobs, educate people for jobs in the restaurant business. And
the mayor has always said that the art and the culture element is just that additional benefit the city gains, in addition to the potential for job training.
We've been talking with Greg Tejeda, who is a reporter covering the city of Gary for the Post-Tribune. Greg, thank you once again, as always, for helping us out with the stories that you've covered in print as well as online. And we'll be checking back with you soon, I hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Thursday, which means, of course, it's our Reporters Roundtable Thursday discussion of the big issues of Northwest Indiana as well as across the Hoosier State. And let's bring Andy Ober back in from Inside Indiana Business Radio to talk about some of the things that have come up around the Hoosier State and some new developers as well, too. Andy, thanks for coming back with us here on the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's take up the topic first here about Purdue University, the Purdue Research Foundation, getting involved with an organization that is going to help create expansion of not only technology, but maybe even some business in Indiana.
Yeah, what you have here really are two hubs of innovation deciding to work together, and I think this is going to result in growth for both of them. So Purdue University, and specifically the Purdue Research Foundation, which is basically the research and technology commercialization arm, are joining forces with Westgate Authority and Naval Surface Warfare Center Crane Division, basically Westgate at Crane. And the Purdue Research Foundation is going to be overseeing and really driving a lot of the R&D and technology commercialization efforts that will take place throughout Indiana and even beyond. So what you're going to be seeing from Purdue is programming, intellectual property support, entrepreneurial services for Westgate tenants. So a lot of this is support for, okay, we've developed a technology at Westgate. What do we then do with it? How do we turn this from concept into product that we can market to other companies? And the Purdue Research Foundation obviously has a lot of strength in this area. So its entrepreneurs and residents and its experts will be working with Westgate to help turn these innovations from Westgate into real products that they can market to clients. Another interesting part of this is that Purdue is also reaching out to and working with Indiana University to see what support Indiana University can also support. So this is not an exclusive partnership. Purdue is really driving it, but it is also welcoming in, as I said, Indiana University and other partners potentially into this effort. And ultimately, the goal is a world-class entrepreneurship and innovation hub at Westgate.
And is it just obvious that it should include Indiana University, since that's the university that's physically closest to the facility there? The Crane Naval Surface Warfare Center, as it's often known, started out, of course, as just a big ammo depot there in southern Indiana, south of Bloomington. Out in the countryside, it was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres that was used out there for just research into naval weapons. But it has really, really evolved over the last certainly 20 years into something, as we've talked here and what you mentioned, Andy, is much more involved and is much more important to the state's economic development. So it does make sense that IU should get part of the partnership in this, too.
Yeah, and, you know, IU's Vice President for Engagement, Bill Steffen, who's a big name in innovation in Indiana as well, has said, you know, look, these are Indiana's two major research universities. It makes sense for us to work together on an effort like this and at Westgate at Crane, which is such an important research and development hub, you know, and obviously also, you know, the Battery Innovation Center, things like that. So, yeah, the more parties, the better as far as startup creation, commercialization. They are basically saying this is really going to help move that economic development needle in the area.
Mm-hmm. Now, if anybody went down to that area now, that's going to be developed into this Westgate Center over time, what are folks likely to see down there?
Well, Purdue is going to have you know, physical presence there. They are going to have staffing there. They're going to bring people out there. So there will be a presence from Purdue, and ultimately, I'm sure, Indiana University as well. But also the hope here is that this will spur economic activity not only in but around around Westgate. You know, ultimately the goal for any of these innovations is to become marketable products, and to do that you need suppliers, you need outside help, companies working with companies. So I think a lot of the hope here is not only will this spur development in Westgate, but it will spur development around Westgate as these companies and these technologies need additional support from other sectors and other businesses.
We're talking with Andy Ober with Inside Indiana Business Radio here as we continue on our Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking. One of the other topics that just come up in the news, Andy, I know that you folks there have covered and been brought to us here on the Inside Indiana Business Reports is the new developments of another major expansion of a United Parcel Service, UPS as people know it, with a big hub that's expected expected to be expanded in Plainfield. And I know that even recently, even our State House reporter, Brandon Smith, talked about the fact that this is going to be a real big test, I guess, the first maybe big test of the new General Assembly approved plans for improving infrastructure, roads and bridges and the like here, because we're going to see a lot more truck traffic in that area.
Right, and this was great news because so much of Indiana's economic momentum recently has been in the tech sector, and that is great, but Indiana is still very much a state that makes and moves things, and this was a huge reminder of the strength of Indiana's logistics sector. So UPS announced plans for a $260 million investment into this Plainfield hub, and it could result in nearly 580 new jobs by 2023. And importantly, UPS says these are jobs that will pay higher than the state average mm-hmm. currently. So this is a huge facility, 893,000 square foot. It's already under construction. They hope to have it fully up and running sometime in 2019. But like you said, very much at the center of this is truck traffic, moving products, and it will be a big test of these infrastructure improvements. Obviously, the infrastructure improvements are years and years and years in the making, but UPS is placing a big bet on the fact that these infrastructure improvements will take place and hold because they are really doubling down on Indiana, Plainfield, obviously, in particular, to say, you know, we are going to be moving things throughout here. So this this is a really big deal, for UPS. Obviously, FedEx also has a big presence here. So it really is a reminder of the logistics strength of Indiana, not only because of the workforce here, the tradition here, but also just because of the fortune of location. They call it the crossroads of America for a reason, and Indiana has very nice access to a lot of major hubs, and this is a very important location for companies like UPS, for FedEx to set up shop.
Now, before we let you go, Andy, to get back to your duties there with Inside Indiana Business, one other topic that has just come up during the week in the news across the state mainly affects central Indiana and some portions of Ohio, but it does have an interesting parallel impact here in northwest Indiana. Mars Supermarkets, which has, unfortunately, its counterpart up here in Illinois, Central Grocers, fallen on economic hard times because of all of the competition that the supermarket business faces with competition like Walmart, Costco, I guess, to a point as well, too. You've got, of course, Amazon.com and Peapod and all the other alternatives that a person can take advantage of rather than getting in their car or hopping on the bus and going to the supermarket. And obviously, all of this has put a big strain on Mars Supermarkets. And we've heard in the news, of course, too, that they have a couple companies, interestingly enough, both of them in Ohio bases. One of them familiar to some, if at least to the business people, a company that is a subsidiary of the Kroger company. And another company in Ohio are going to go through, I guess, the list of Mars Supermarkets in Indiana and Ohio and divvy them up and decide which ones are going to keep open and which ones are going to close.
Yeah, so they're subsidiaries of Kroger and Fresh Encounter, and they have combined, are looking to buy 26 locations of Mars's remaining locations, which leaves 18 that were not chosen for sale. And starting today, actually, liquidation begins at those locations. And you mentioned grocery delivery services, Peapod, Amazon, but I think also continued pressure from superstores like Walmart and Target, yeah, where people can do more of their shopping. It's not just grocery specific. You know, so if they're going out to get medicine or get whatever else they're getting, they can also grocery shop. And I think just like you are dealing with Strachan Van Til there, a lot of this is just kind of a sentimental blow because Marsh has been such a prominent name in central Indiana for so long that it really, while I don't think many people were surprised by this, it really is just something that is kind of sad for people because it has been such a prominent name for so long in central Indiana. So, while it is good to see that some of these stores were purchased, it is unfortunate to see that many are closing. And, of course, the most important part of that are the people who make their livelihoods through those stores. Obviously, Kroger has tried to snap up a lot of these people, whether they're in management or meat cutters or, you know, cashiers, baggers, whoever. But obviously not all of them are going to be able to make that move. And really that is obviously the biggest disappointment with us all.
I suppose we can only hope that that some of these stores that are going to be closed up as part of the liquidation of Mars Supermarkets, when the new owners take over, they'll maybe have an opportunity to take another look at some of these places if they, I guess, get enough support. Enough support locally, certainly, from the communities that these places are closing, and then hopefully they can get them reopened, or somebody else will be out there, or some other smaller company might be out there and maybe pick up a few of these along the way, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Marsh, you know, one thing Marsh does have is prominent locations, and while they may not fit for Kroger or whoever else's plan, maybe there are some others who they do. I mean, there are some prominent and high traffic locations where Marshes are, including some of these that were not chosen for sale. So yes, hopefully, you know, whether it's another grocery company or who else, hopefully you will see these properties become productive again in the very near future.
And we see the parallel here, of course, in Northwest Indiana with the latest word that it seems that if everything goes as hoped, that Jewel Osco will be able to shift into some of these stores. They have a few locations, of course, already in Northwest Indiana, but if they take on some of the selected Strack and Van Til stores, they'll be able to keep them open. And I know there's even some whisperings among folks in town saying that maybe the guy who's the CEO of Strack's will in turn take up maybe buy a few of the stores for himself. We'll just have to wait and find out here. You just never know about these things. I think probably more people are concerned about what's going to happen to all the ultra supermarkets, because a lot of them covered neighborhoods that will, right now are just borderline food deserts. And unfortunately, some neighborhoods will definitely become food deserts when the ultra supermarkets close up. And we're starting to see that process happen right now here in Lake County in particular. So we'll just have to see how the parallels run. It'll be interesting to keep an eye on how Mars Supermarkets comes out of all of this as well, too, as what happens with the Central Grocers and Strack and Van Til and Ultra Supermarkets up here in the region. We've been talking with Andy Ober, who's with Inside Indiana Business Radio. Andy, thanks for your help today on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday.
Happy to do it. Thanks again for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, the Reporter Roundtable Thursdays. I'm Chris Nolte, and now in the studio with me to get caught up on some Northwest Indiana stories of interest recent, we have Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks for coming in today.
Glad to be here.
One of the big stories that has come about actually came about as just a regularly scheduled appearance before a Chamber of Commerce. The president and CEO of a company called Fig Bridge Projects, which is based in Tallahassee, Florida, Linda Fig, came in to speak before the Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce meeting yesterday. That was over at the Ameristar Casino in East Chicago. In fact, East Chicago, an apt place for her to speak, because she's coming in. Her company, along with others that are working with her, are the ones that are going to be putting up a new Klein Avenue toll bridge.
Correct, yeah. The plan is that if all goes well, they'll be ready to go in 2019. It's an ambitious project, and it'll require no tax dollars at all. It's all private. I asked him, I said, how are you able to do that? And he said that as a result of the tolls that they'll be charging, they're able to maintain it, pay for everything, which for the mayor and the other representatives, there was a good bit of news, because they want the project, but they don't want to have to pay for it.
Now, you listened to Linda Fig talk, and you had a chance to talk with her too, but you also talked with the principals that are actually going to be involved in the day-to-day work on this project here in East Chicago, another company that is apparently affiliated with the Fig Bridge Partners is the project manager, that I understand.
Right, yeah. What they do is it's sort of like a big Lego set. What they do, they precast the pieces, they prefabricate them, and they stockpile them. And then when they have enough of them, they just put it up and piece by piece, and they say that it's a faster way to put it together.
I know that one of the concerns in years past, the problems before, that kind of led to the closing of the old Klein Avenue Bridge was the fact that it was poorly constructed. But I think, as I recall, in reading reports and hearing people from eyewitness reports of what had happened when the that bridge started to collapse, and problems where there just wasn't built right on the spot. So this might be a better, more efficient way of putting it up.
Yeah, this company actually is world renowned for its designs, and they've had some awards that they've won for construction. And again, the way they're doing them in sections, and they've done this particular bridge or something very similar to it in multiple locations around the country. So it's a tried and tested formula, according to them.
When you heard Linda Figg talk about this yesterday, she obviously had a chance to refer to the situation in East Chicago, and she's been obviously trying to do a very good sales job to the people, not only to the city officials in East Chicago, but to the residents in the community and all of Northwest Indiana, that this will be a much, much better bridge that could ever have been constructed on the spot, and in turn trying to get away from the bad history that the Klein Avenue Bridge seems to have had.
Yeah. She seems to have sold it in that respect, but people hate the idea of a toll road. They would rather it be free like it was before. The builders are saying in order to have this quality of bridge, it'll be an electronic tollway just like you have with the iPass. Mm-hmm. It'll be monitored. They'll take care of everything. No taxes. And it'll be $225, and they said they're going to really try and keep it to that number. Now, I can understand it, though. I talked to a number of people, and they don't want to have to pay. But for what you're getting, nothing's free.
What do they say as far as the timetable is concerned? You gave us the overall plan. It's going to be just a few years down the road here. Mm-hmm. Do they say when they're going to be able to start work, or have they actually begun work?
They're saying they're going to be able to start work in about 4 to 5 months. And what they have to do is build a bigger building. And what happens is that they put the pieces in that building.
Mm-hmm.
Another good thing is that this means a big deal to local contractors. They're going to need a ton of cement. And there's an actual company in East Chicago that'll get a lot of that business. In addition to that, they need a lot of steel. And we have a steel mill right here, so it'll be really good in that respect for those local contractors.
Is it, a project that they feel that once they get this building put up, the big building put up, and where they're going to be able to keep these components in storage, that they can work weather, regardless of what the weather is, because we know winters there along the lakefront can get pretty brutal, especially people who've worked at Inland Steel in the years past and ArcelorMittal now know how nasty it can get sometimes in wintertime.
That was part of their plan. They say that the way this is mapped out, they prefabricate those pieces and they have that building to actually store them until such a time as they have all they need in the spring, and then they'll erect it and get it up pretty quickly, according to them.
We're talking with Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore. He's covering some of the stories. One of them in particular was yesterday's appearance at the Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce event at the Ameristar Casino in East Chicago of Linda Figg, who's the president and CEO of Figg Bridge Partners, the overall company that is based in Florida and is in turn working with their local affiliates to be able to construct the new Klein Avenue toll bridge that is going to be going up to fill the void left by the other bridge that was, of course, demolished but had to be closed and abandoned because of structural issues. Had a chance to talk with people who feel that regardless of the fact that it's going to be a more expensive bridge and it's going to be a toll bridge, that they feel more comfortable with the fact that this is going to be a much improved bridge compared to what was there before.
Well, what's interesting is that they aren't talking about that. Mm-hmm. They're more talking about the fact that it's a toll and that they have to pay. The people I spoke to really hate that. But now the public officials, they love the fact that it's built by a company that has a name. Down in Virginia, there are a number of these types of bridges. They've done them. They're heavy-handy problems, so they're just going to replicate it here. So in that respect, the safety concerns will be much more allayed because they've done this already.
Okay. One of the other stories that you've covered here, and we've brought you here on Lakeshore Public Radio this week, include, efforts to try to help give young people in Northwest Indiana who may not have a good lunch coming because they aren't in school schools closed for the summer months, and there are special summer feeding programs that are out there, and you had a chance to check one of them out here in the communities. Tell us about that.
With the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana in East Chicago, they have an arrangement with the East Chicago Park District where they will actually go and deliver food for the kids. So the lunches that they used to get and the breakfast that they used to get, they can now get that at these summer programs. And, you know, it really means a big deal for these kids, you know, to hear some of the stories of how, you know, the students will come in and they'll ask for two lunches or two breakfast meals because they're not getting what they need at home. So this program really fills the void, according to the people who work in this in the park district and actually deal with the kids.
When you had a chance to check one of these programs out, was it located in Gary or was it in one of the other cities?
It was actually in East Chicago.
East Chicago.
And what they do, they partner with the park district that are already doing youth summer programs, and so they just provide them with the food.
What the folks at the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana that are working on these programs all the time, they've got very much involved for the summer feeding months, they must feel like they get some great satisfaction out of helping not only family members but young people in particular make sure that they have the meals that they need during the summer.
Well, they do because I've heard the same story from those folks as well. They know, you know, working in the area of providing food, there was actually a study out that said I think it was 4 out of 5 of the kids that they surveyed were food insecure, which means they weren't getting enough food. So they have the numbers, they've heard the stories, and they're glad to provide that service because you know, it gives the kids what they need, which is something to eat.
Bring us up to date with some of the other stories that you've had a chance to talk about here on Lakeshore Public Radio this week.
Well, actually, some of the ones that I'm working on, there's a story out of East Chicago where there was some concern with some of the people who had to relocate in the locations where they were moving. They actually were afraid of their for their safety. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking into that. One of the issues is that you know, when I did have a chance to talk to some of the people who were relocating the people, they said, well, you know, they've had a couple of years, and these last holdouts, when they try to go and look for some place, it's up to the point now where there is no more room at the inn. You have to leave. Mm-hmm. I spoke with some officials, and I guess there are 3 families that are still left at the West Calumet projects. So, you know, most of them have relocated. But, you know, the transition isn't as smooth as some would have hoped because they are having some issues with being concerned about their safety in the places that they have to move.
I understand that, and the words come out, that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is going to have some regional staffers come in again on a regular basis into East Chicago to pick up what had been promised some time ago to have regular, almost weekly meetings with the residents that are there. And it's not only, I'm sure, the West Calumet district, since most of the people, as you just mentioned, are moved out already, but there are other neighborhoods and other places that in East Chicago that are very much concerned about the lead contamination.
They are doing that. They actually came out with a list, and it goes all the way through August, mm-hmm. And they will have regular meetings pretty much to field questions, answer any issues that the people might have, which is a big deal because they are really looking for as much information as they can get. You know, where do I go to get my filters? Are there other opportunities that I can utilize for housing? Are there places where I can get my testing done for the lead? So, yeah, there's a lot of information that they're looking for. And the fact that they have that person come in is going to really benefit them.
I mean, only got about a minute left here, Stephen. In talking with people, have you feel that these folks are maybe they hadn't been getting answers from City Hall, that they're finally starting to get answers? Or are they just hoping that they'll be able to find out more from right from the source, so to speak, from the EPA?
Well, in my being out there, I think that the city is doing a better job at getting that information out. But it's a situation where they want as much as they can
right.
get. No matter what you give, they want more, which I can understand. If you're in that situation, you want to know the most updated information as soon as possible. And I think maybe the EPA could do a little better, mm-hmm. and that's why they're doing this right. outreach, because they're There are times I call over there, I can't get an answer.
Yeah, that's right. It's difficult to find out, and
I'm actually excited about this, too, because I want to be able to go and find out what the latest information is, if there's any deadlines or anything I need to be aware of as well.
Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio with us talking about some of the stories and topics that he's worked on and is working on here that you'll get to hear on Lakeshore Public Radio. That's it for Regionally Speaking for this week and for our Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks to all of our reporters who helped us out with their topics that they brought up today, and we appreciate that. And we hope that you'll join us again when we're back on Monday with more discussions.